Welcome to the Maine Science Podcast. I'm Kate Dickerson. Before I introduce our guest, a quick note that at the end of this episode, there's some more updates about the 2022 Maine Science Festival. Today's episode is a conversation with Ali Abedi, a professor in the Department of Computer and Electrical Engineering at the University of Maine. Ali's research work is a remarkable example of how one area of engineering, in his case, wireless sensor networks, has applications in many different areas, including detecting air leaks in space, solar power, and neurological impacts from trauma, cognitive impairments, and detecting Alzheimer's. Some of those things actually measured during sleep. But Ali's work is more than just sensors, and part of our conversation is also about building Maine's first CUBE satellite. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Ali, welcome to the Maine Science Podcast. Thanks for your time. You're one of my favorite people to talk to, and I always feel like I learn something new. So that is not a way to put pressure on you. That's just to let you know how much I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Thanks for having me.
I was hoping you could tell us not just how you got to Maine, because like me, I know you're not a native Mainer, but we claim it as our state. But you could tell us how you got into science and engineering in particular.
That's an interesting question. Kind of brings back me to my fourth grade in elementary school when my uncle brought me a kit of an FM transmitter. So he said, if you put these things together and solder it, which my mom was opposing, I said, he's going to burn his hands with this soldering iron. But my uncle said, okay, if you do this, then some magic will happen. So I was curious. So I started to read the instructions and followed, you know, soldered one component at a time. And then when I was speaking in the microphone of that FM transmitter, everybody could hear me in the radios in their entire neighborhood. And I said, wow, that's magic, right? How the signals travel all over the world and all over the neighborhood. So then I asked my uncle if I want to learn how to design something like this or build something better than this. He said, oh, you want to be an electrical engineer. So I knew from my first grade that I want to become an electrical engineer. But in order to get there, I had to spend quite a bit of time with my math and physics teachers because those are the fundamentals of electrical engineering. And I fell in love with math and physics in the high school and then ended up with electrical engineering. That's when I realized at the university that the more science background you have, you know, in math and physics, the easier would be the engineering job for you. And that's how I kind of continued my area in electrical engineering.
So was your uncle an engineer?
No, he was not an engineer. Actually, he was a technician. So he was good with technical stuff. But he was not an engineer. He was more like a technician can repair different things, which is, again, totally different than an engineer. Because when I got my engineering degree, then in the family, people will come to me and say, oh, my TV is broken. Can you fix it? And say, no, they didn't thought of that at the school. So go see my uncle.
You can tell them how the TV works, but you can't fix it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's as an engineer, I look at engineers as more like creating something based on some science. So you first need to learn the science to understand how things work, and then you create some new stuff like TVs and cell phones and internet, which when I tell my kids that when I was a kid, there was no cell phone and no internet, then I get this, you know, shocking face that how did you guys live? You know,
it's a wonder we survived. You and I have known each other for more than a couple of years. And I know that signals and communication of various sorts have always been a part of your work. I am gobsmacked that started with fourth grade and putting together a transmitter. That's really cool. Did you ever think of doing anything else, or was that always just what hooked you completely?
I had my doubts. I mean, I was interested to help people. So I was thinking about medical field. So in addition to engineering, and when I came to sort of a senior years of high school, I started to talk to some of my teachers and my parents, you know, and other people that who were like first year engineers or medical doctors to try to figure out which one I'm going to do. And then I realized that if you go to engineering, there is actually a field within electrical engineering and mechanical engineering called biomedical engineering, so that you can actually become engineer, but to still help people in biomedical field. So that kind of convinced me to go to the engineering and still be able to do my, you know, helping people and the medical field and all that. And in fact, in some of my research work, I've been working with some biomedical engineers. So we collaborated, created biomedical devices, things like that. So to me, again, summarizing the entire engineering world in one word is basically problem solvers, right? So if you learn engineering, then the problems come at you. It might be environmental, it might be, you know, medicine related, it might be something, you know, related to your day-to-day activities, and you need to learn how to use your mathematics and physics tools to solve them. That's kind of the bottom line for engineers.
So I know you didn't grow up in the States and you went to Canada for grad school. Was that a difficult adjustment to go from where you grew up to the dark cold of Canada?
It was a culture shock and a climate shock, you know, for me. So I was born and raised in Iran and I lived there for 25 years. I did my bachelor's and master's degree there. So you can imagine from a very crowded city like Tehran, which is over 10 to 15 million people living in a small 20 kilometer by 20 kilometer square. So there's always hundreds of people around you. The weather is hot. The culture is different. So I said, okay, I'm going to do my PhD in Canada. So I went to a place that the first reaction was that, where is everybody? And I was told, this is it. I mean, this is everybody. I mean, I couldn't see anybody around there. So that was a big shock. Of course, the climate there was very cold compared to where I was coming from. And I think, in fact, it was just too cold for me. So I had to move a little bit more south to Maine to be a little bit more comfortable. So I did overcome all the culture shock and climate shock in Canada. So moving from Canada to Maine was not really that difficult at the point. So
you, Maine, you arrived in, if I have it right, 2005.
Yeah.
And how you and I first met was talking about sensors and the communication that can be done with these really tiny sensors. And if I remember correctly, it involved the International Space Station. And I know that I am leaping at least a decade of work there of what you had from when you got to Maine to when we met. But if you could just talk a little bit about your research and what it's like for you to be at a university doing that research, that would be really cool.
No, the reason I selected UMaine to come here was that they had a very long tradition of a strong material science, physics, and sensor background. So out of the physics department and electrical engineering department, I think there were a few professors, they got together, they created a world-class laboratory back in 2004 and 5, exactly when I joined. I just came into a brand new building, a brand new laboratory called, at the time, it had a different name, but today they call it Frontiers in Sensor Research and Technology FIRST. And because of that long tradition of sensors, they're very well established worldwide in terms of material science and sensors. My interest was on wireless communication, sensor networks. And I felt, okay, there is a very good match here. I can come and help get those sensors outside of the lab and take them to the field. At the time, I didn't think I can take them to the space, but just taking them out of the lab and take it to the environment was kind of my first goal. So that's how everything got started here. And for the space station project, we first started actually with instrumenting NASA's inflatable lunar habitat structure with wireless sensors. That's back in 2007, 2008 timeframe. Through that project, we realized that no matter how airtight is your system, there is always going to be the leak. So we had a couple of fans running all the time. And we realized, okay, you can't really run fans in Mars or Moon. You need to really be very judicious with your air supply. So we proposed this idea to NASA that what if we create a system for detecting air leaks inside pressurized space vehicles? And of course, we were not at the point at that time to send lunar habitat to Mars to test it. But they said, okay, we have ISS right up here and they are losing air all the time. So how about you guys help us identify the location of air? So that's how the International Space Station project started. We started to build wireless sensors for localizing the location of the leak automatically versus the system they have today is basically the air pressure drops. And then the Houston will tell them you're losing air. then one person will go and grab a boom and, you know, kind of sweeps the walls to figure out where is the leak, and they go out and fix it. So we try to automate this mainly because air is precious, and also the crew time is even more precious than that. Every single minute of what the crew will do on a space station is already programmed. So we need to make sure that we take advantage of any technology that we can to be able to save their time. That's how we got into that space station project.
Maybe you can explain exactly what these sensors look like. It's remarkable, I think, what you can convey and what information you can get from the size of the sensors.
Yeah, those sensors are pretty small, probably like a few millimeters in dimension. And what they do, they are like dog's ears, right? So they can actually hear ultrasonic sounds that human ears cannot hear. The signal coming out of those sensors are related to the signals coming from the air leak, right? So if you have multiple of those sensors in different areas, based on the signal level that they receive and based on the angle of arrival of your signal, which you can calculate using mathematical phase equations, you can pinpoint the location of air leak. But the challenge here is that the signal that comes out of the sensors is going to be very noisy. You may end up detecting hundreds of leak locations, which are not actually true. Only one out of that hundreds or thousands of locations are true. So then you need to employ lots of interesting concepts from mathematics, like especially in statistics, like Bayesian theory and tree search algorithms and Kalman filtering and things like that, to be able to figure out how much noise is there, how you can eliminate the noisy points, how you can find the location which is the most probable location of the leak. And with that, a combination of the physical characteristics of the signals coming out of a tiny air leak, which just you can imagine you have a balloon or like your car or bicycle's tire has a tiny hole, you can hear the hiss sound of the air escaping. In a space, you can't really hear anything outside because there is no air outside, so there is no sound transmission. But inside of the space station, what you can hear is this vibrations of the edges of the hole, which comes at a very high frequency. Sometimes the speed of air that is escaping the space station is going to even reach the speed of sound. So it's going to be extremely fast air going out, because outside this vacuum, of course, inside is pressurized. But those vibrations of the holes become some sort of ultrasonic vibration, similar to like ultrasonic brush, toothbrush or something like that. And then the sensors will receive this data. So we get this engineering hardware, we get the mathematical and physical concept, and then we get some software for processing. So all of these together will give us the location of the leak. So that's how the system works.
So that's a team of, I'm thinking, five or six people, different expertise to make sure that that one sensor can work. Does that sound right?
That's true. I mean, today, every complex problem we have is too complex to be done or solved by one person. So I'm very much in favor of teamwork, interdisciplinary work, things like that. And this was a very good example of that.
What's your research that you're working on now?
So my research, I mean, in general, in the past 16 years has been in the same area of wireless sensor networks, trying to find problems and solve them. And in addition to the lunar habitat and a space station work that I mentioned, we also work on the solar panels of a space station to measure the micrometeorite and space debris impact on those. But I also work on biomedical field with some colleagues in neuroscience area, trying to, again, use wireless sensors for monitoring people during sleep, detecting mild traumatic brain injury, mild cognitive impairment, and also early Alzheimer's disease onset and things like that. Going along the same lines of research in wireless sensor networks, most recently, in the past year or so, we have been working on building Maine's first small satellite. So we call that a CubeSat, which is, quoting actually our president, is the size of a loaf of a bread. So it's like a 10 by 10 by 30 centimeter satellite. And I have a group of students here working on that. So we hope we can actually launch that to space next year, next June of 22. So
I'm going to make you back up and explain how wireless sensing and the biometric stuff can help detect an early onset of Alzheimer's with sleep studies?
So we started this work almost now over 11 years ago. So I have a collaborator in neuroscience and psychology, and we also work with Acadia Hospital and that. So the idea is that when you have something abnormal going on in your brain, it might have something to do with a sleep disruption. And the way we are trying to measure those is very simple. So just imagine you're sleeping in your bed and you're kind of tossing and turning around. Basically, your brain tells your body, okay, now you have to turn this way and now you have to do this. But you can't really move unless you have some energy for that. So you need to actually burn some calories to actually move. But in order to burn those calories, you need some oxygen. So that means that when you start moving, your respiratory rate should go up because you need more oxygen. You burn your calories and then you turn around and you settle down, your respiratory signal goes down. We noticed that if you measure the changes in respiration and movement in sleep and correlate them, you can see in a very young, healthy adult, the delay between the time that you start to move and your respiratory goes up and comes down is very minimal. It's almost instantaneous. But if you have something going on in your brain, let's say you had a concussion on the field in a sports, then you will see significant delays from the time you move and the time your respiratory signal changes. So your brain actually slows down a little bit. It's like when your computer is a little bit slow today and you know you want to click and you're waiting for that click to actually do something for you. And you click again and, you know, make it even worse. So it's the same situation with concussion on the field, and the same situation with aging brain. So when your brain starts to age and your sort of neurocognitive capabilities start to decline, your brain gets slower and slower. And same thing for like traumatic brain injury. So we basically studied all these different things, and we realized that with those delays that are between the respiratory changes and movement, if you process them appropriately, you can actually figure out if something is changing in some person's, you know, body. So how did we verify this? We recruited 100 people. So 50 of them are normal. The other 50 have been diagnosed with early Alzheimer's disease. So we had help from Center on Aging, from Acadia Hospital, from University of New England. So we recruited from Bangor and Portland area and the vicinity. And then they didn't tell us who is normal and who is Alzheimer's disease. So we put them on these sensors. So the sensors were installed in their own home, inside their own bed. So they feel comfortable sleeping on their own bed rather than, you know, taking them to a sleep lab and wire them up. So, and then we got the data back. So we run that through an artificial intelligence system to be able to categorize them and figure out which people are different than the others. And based on that, we put people either in a normal category or early Alzheimer's category. And almost with accuracy of 90%, we can say if a person is in this category or not. So basically, you can tell our artificial intelligence was trained by a medical doctor who makes the diagnostic. And now that artificial intelligence is trained, we lock it and then we can use it in future for assisting physicians to be able to get this data in people's home, rather than having them to go to a sleep lab and spend several thousand dollars. So this will cost them, let's say, a couple hundred versus several thousand dollars. So it's a lot of saving in the healthcare, but that's kind of the science behind it.
Did you happen upon noticing that there was a difference in the brain of people who have some type of injury or disorder, or was it something you were specifically looking for?
No, this has been studied quite significantly in the literature of the sleep community. So we knew that there are some differences, but there hasn't been any sort of in-home device to actually measure that. They knew this is there is something related to the brain and sleep. There is tons of literature about it, but again, people had to go to sleep labs and get, you know, tested. But most of those research were related to sleep disorders and, you know, things like sleep apnea or, you know, sleep problems, but it was not really connected until the recent few years into the Alzheimer's disease or traumatic brain injury. So we try to make it possible by looking at 100 patients versus like one person in the lab. And I think that's kind of was the novelty of this work.
90% seems like a really impressive rate to me to know without a lot of question. That's pretty impressive.
I wish. I mean, FDA was that impressed. They were not. They basically said, oh, 100 people you tested? Okay, how about 10,000 people? And we said, okay, that's next, right?
So, all right. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit because I know one of your many other hats, I'm convinced actually, the more I talk to you, the less I think you sleep, is that you help run the Center for Undergraduate Research at the University of Maine. And this is one of those sweet spots, I think, for the University of Maine that is largely unknown, certainly off campus, and may not even be as well known on campus as it should be. So I am interested in you taking as much time as you want to talk about the Cougar program and also explaining what the undergraduate research program in general is.
Yeah, sure. So Center for Undergraduate Research was established almost over a decade ago. There was a committee of faculty from Honors College and several other colleges. They get together and they started this as a committee. And the main motivation behind that was that students who come to university, if they get engaged with faculty member in some sort of research or experiential learning, they are more likely to remain motivated. They are more likely to graduate in the same major they come in. So the retention would be higher. And also when they come out of the university, they are more desirable employees for employers because they had done some research and hands-on work rather than just going to the lecture and coming out. So that was the motivation. We were basically starting this as a very small group, but then we had this snowball effect that people started to learn the advantage of this, not only for undergraduate students who responded really well to this and started to apply for fellowship, started to come to a symposium, but also for faculty who realized that there is more potential to undergraduate researchers than they thought originally. So they can help them with generating data, more research work and more proposals and more papers. But also for graduate students, that was another interesting opportunity that not only they could help the undergrads as a mentor, but also they could improve their own resume as a graduate student who have done mentoring during the graduate school, which is not really normal. So usually you do your grad school and then you get a postdoc and that's when you get to do mentoring. So it was a win-win for everybody. We were lucky to get support internally from university to do this work. And then we started getting external grants and funds. But just to give you the scale of the growth of this program in the past decade, starting from the first symposium, we had around 30, 40 people. And the last symposium we held in person was over 2,000 attendees. So it kind of doubled up almost every year. But in addition to supporting students for their research, we also support faculty with professional development workshops on how to create a specific, measurable, attainable, and related and time-limited goals for the undergrads. We call it SMART objectives, according to NASA terminology. So that how to mentor undergraduate students, what's the difference between mentoring undergrads and grads, where are the funding sources for undergrads. And we promote this among faculty. We help the students to learn how to write proposals, how to make presentations. And also, in addition to these programs, we are also involved with running a new certificate program across campus, which was basically enabled by the Harold Alfond Foundation gift. And we call that Experiential Programs Innovation Central or EPIC certificate. So that students get trained in research methods, in presentation and skills, things that you don't learn in the regular college courses. And we hope that with this centralized support that we have, we can kind of integrate the research into the fabric of the university, not only in the research lab, but also in the classroom. So this way students feel that they are different, you know, than other competing schools here, and employers love that. So that's kind of big picture overview of Cougar programs.
And if I have it correctly, the Cougar program is not focused solely on the sciences and engineering. Is that true?
That's true. And in fact, we define research and experiential learning as a very broad term. We believe that if you bring an artist and a social scientist and an engineer and a physicist together, you can have a much higher impact to solve very complex societal problems that we have, rather than a single investigator, you know, one discipline sort of work. So we heavily promote multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary work among Cougar students and faculty.
One of the things I specifically wanted to ask you about, I know I'm jumping around a little bit here, but I know that you're used to it. I'm not sure if anybody else is. You were a NASA fellow in 2016, and I'm just a faculty fellow at NASA. I'm just curious what that means. I think you and I have had this conversation before that NASA holds this iconic place in the heart of many people, whether they're scientists or not. Like, they have in so many ways embodied everything that people think is good about government. So, you know, they're held up in this really interesting light. And I'm just curious what it means to be a NASA faculty fellow.
So that's a good question. So basically, NASA has this program that if a faculty member from university wants to collaborate with them on a research project, either you have active grants with them or you have a Space Act agreement, things like that, or you just want to start a new project, you can work with the center. So in that specific program, so I spent one summer in 2016 at NASA Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, and I was working with their wireless sensing group over there to basically review their technology roadmap, and basically generated a report of what wireless technologies are being used right now in space and what is the potential for future use of wireless technology. The main sort of thing that NASA is very famous for is the reliability of their process and their operation. After the couple of shuttle accidents that we had, they have been really revising their processes to make sure that everything is reliable, everything is working. So because of that, they have multiple redundancy. There are lots of cables, there are lots of connectors, lots of sensors. So what I was trying to promote there during the time I was a fellow there, trying to go to different centers and different researchers there to promote the use of wireless technology to still maintain the reliability, but eliminating the extra weight of those wires. And those are like kilometers and kilometers of wires. And there is like extreme additional weight added to the vehicles because of all those wires. So I generated a report kind of reviewing the technology for them. And at the same time, this is the time I was actually trying to prepare our payload for a space station launch. So I was also getting some training at the operations center over there on how to talk to ISS people, you know, and kind of be ready for the operation of our system. And I collaborate with that center. So after I left and came back here, I keep sending students as interns to that center. We still have contracts and grants together. But basically, that's what the NASA Fellow Program entails.
Are you surprised that as a faculty member, you are still required and able to do all of these programs that where you learn new stuff all the time? You know, it's not like you become a faculty member and you get tenure and you're all done. You really continue to expand and reach out and do all sorts of new things. Was that what you were expecting?
I was not expecting, you know, when I was undergraduate, a student, I was learning, you know, how a BJT transistor works. I thought, oh, wow, now I learn transistors. I can go and define things. But as soon as I graduated, those were like history. So then there were some other class of transistors came out, which I didn't know anything about. So I had to go and learn. And then I said, okay, this is it. Now I learned these new ones and I'm in a company working, or now I'm at the university. So now I can feel comfortable. I know everything. And then suddenly next year, I realized those are obsolete. So then after a few years, I realized that whatever you learn is just going to last for a couple of years. So you need to be able to learn the tools. You learn the fundamentals. The things I learned in, you know, basic physics and basic mathematics, they remain the same. So I still use that fundamental knowledge to be able to learn new stuff. So I call it a lifelong learning, right? Every day there is a new project, there is a new learning. And that's what actually makes a faculty job exciting and interesting, and also keeps the students motivated and going. But I certainly didn't expect that when I was a student.
I'm going to just ask you one other question. Do you have a project that you're prepping for or that you're working on right now that we haven't talked about that you're really excited about?
Yes, we are very excited about building a CubeSat. That's Maine's first small satellite to go to space. I'm very excited about that. I have a very good team of students here at the University of Maine. And we also collaborate with a couple of faculty members at the University of Southern Maine and a couple of students there. You know, the cool thing about this project is that it was not my idea. It was actually some of the middle school and high school students' ideas in Maine. So we sent this call for proposal out and said, okay, what if you had access to space data? What would you do? And we received 11 or 12 proposals from all these different schools across Maine. We reviewed those. Some of them were definitely interesting, but we were not at the level of technology we could do some of those. But we picked three proposals. And one of them was to detect harmful algal blooms in lakes and, you know, in Maine from space. The other one was to identify urban heat islands to be able to be more energy efficient and all that. And the third one was to find the concentration of phytoplanktons in the water through the turbidity of water and things like that. So we picked these three, and then we wrote a proposal to NASA, and we said, okay, here are some science missions that our schools want to do, and we are proposing this engineering device that we want to build and send to space to basically have cameras. You know, these are going to be multi-spectral cameras looking at different parts of spectrum with the wireless radio, all that stuff. And we were very lucky to get funded through that. So that's very exciting because we get to meet with these high school students and teachers almost on a monthly basis, provide updates of what we have designed, and they keep kind of working on the data. It seems a very interesting, you know, multidisciplinary team of students to work together. So I'm very excited about that. And we are almost done actually building our satellite. We are now testing it. And we hope that next January, we do fit check to see if it actually fits inside the dispenser of the NASA launch providers. And then hopefully in June of 22, we'll launch it to space.
How do you do testing of it before the fit test? I mean, what does that mean?
So there are multiple levels of testing. We basically build different parts of the satellite. So we need to build like power system. So power system is like solar panel, chargers, and battery. We need to test that hundreds of times to make sure it works all the time. We need to have a flight computer, which basically designed in a way to manage the entire satellite. So when to turn on what and when to send the data, when to turn off, you know, and that kind of stuff. And you need to run that several times. You can't have something that is like frozen and there's nobody up there to push the restart button. And then we need to also create a system that actually can move the satellite in a space and kind of point it in different directions. We call that attitude determination control system. And we need to test those. And once all these subsystems are tested, we put them all together, test them all together. Then we put it on a shaker table. So we kind of shake this really vigorously based on the profile of the launch so that you put it on the rocket and then they shake it and things, you know, get all disconnected is not good, right? So we test those. And there is a lot of other safety tests we have to go on with NASA and the launch provider. And the last step for them is to, they actually come here and they test, fit check our device inside the dispenser to see if it's a snug fit. And once we pass all of those, then they will accept it as a payload. So.
What a cool project. I didn't realize that it wasn't from you, that it was the proposal. That's really neat. Ali, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and more importantly, all of your work. I am always interested to hear what you're working on next. And I'm always amazed at all the different pieces and parts of, you make me care about sensors in a way I had no idea that I wanted to. So I appreciate that.
Thank you for having me and the opportunity to talk about science with you.
Thanks for listening to the Maine Science Podcast. The MSF team is deep into the planning needed for our return on March 16th through 20th, 2022. As I mentioned in our last episode, the headliner event is The Warming Sea, an exploration of hope in the face of the climate crisis. I also wanted to let you know that we have our call for ideas for programming open until November 19, 2021. I've included a link to the call for ideas in the show notes. The Maine Science Podcast is recorded at Discovery Studios at the Maine Discovery Museum in Bangor, Maine. The Maine Science Podcast is produced and edited by me, Kate Dickerson. I receive production support from Miranda Bouchard and social media support from Next Media. The Discover Maine theme was composed and performed by Nick Parker.